This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoholoon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Toomer are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Hard-traveling fanboys.
When you hear this show, you better run for cover.
I got a 10-inch kielbasa from Klondike Bill.
Hot traveling fanboys.
Slobber.
It's a weekly podcast and you better listen.
Keep your ears in mid-condition.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboys.
You got a 33-in-3rd chance of winning.
Hot traveling fanboys. 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 Our traveling fanboys.
Got two weekly segments coming to your town.
Reading, watching, and the rundown.
Do-do-do-do-do-do.
Thank you.
It's the greatest show on Place to Be Nation.
Certainly a unique situation.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboys.
Oh, they're pretty, they're skittles.
Hot traveling fanboys. 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 Hot traveling fanboys.
You vicious little son of a bitch.
They're indivisible. They're microwavable.
Oh, Mr. Eddie.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboy. Oy, 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 oy.
Are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, you slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question. Give me a minute.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well-kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
I believe it was quite sudden, and
thank you.
Our traveling fanboys.
Hello? Can anyone hear us?
Hi. Hi there.
Nick.
How's it going? What's up?
We're still on the air.
Still. After last week, that's...
I know, I was a little surprised, honestly, when to pull into our studio today and find our equipment still in place, Nick, in the L-shaped studio here to find Hoholoon Plaza not vandalized.
I thought I thought for sure all our stuff would have been destroyed by an optic blast filtered through a ruby quartz crystal.
I thought that was a very good possibility. Barring that, I thought perhaps Akeem and the Big Boss Man would have shown up and trashed Hoholoon Plaza, leaving a mark all over Vancouver, British Columbia.
Well, and luckily, our Jeff Johns shrine over there in the corner was left untouched. That was what I was most concerned about, so we still have that to hold on to.
Absolutely. The members of the Weber family have left us alone. The manager has, with the exception of one Easter egg found in our last podcast, has allowed us to continue existing. So despite the controversy of last week's episode, which I don't know about you, Nick, but I can't remember a more controversial episode, one that's gotten more feedback.
We came after a sacred cow, it seems, for many.
Indeed. But yet we are still here. We're alive. Nick, you have suffered from ailments over the last few days, including traveler's diarrhea, as I understand it.
Wait.
I just wanted to say traveler's diarrhea.
That has not been a problem, but, you know.
Flu-like symptoms.
Symptoms is a good way to describe it. Not been a great couple of days here.
Yeah, well, Friday night was great. Fanboys took over the town of Hilton, Georgia, a town as it is, and just made merry throughout the night alongside a fellow Place to Be Nation pop along Jennifer Smith and Russell Sellers, as well as Mrs. Nick Duke, and we had quite the evening, wouldn't you say?
We did. You know, there were a lot of karaoke stylings involved, not the least of which is probably the best version of Born to Run you will ever hear. On this or any other planet. And then some late night shenanigans as well that featured golf cart joyrides and whatnot. So countdown begins, Greg, to Redneck Karaoke Invitational 2019.
Absolutely. We're gonna set it up. We're gonna have RKI prom.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to be confused with RKO prom.
RKI is RKI prom. You know, if there's music and stuff, there's not really a wrestling event. So I guess those are one and the same in our case.
We could definitely get Jenny back with RKO prom, though.
Yeah, we probably could. I would advise her to leave her purse at home if she were to attend such a thing.
Nonetheless, that notwithstanding, we had a great time. We will do it again in the future and report all of our shenanigans, or most of our shenanigans, back to you, our adoring public. Now, why are we gathered this week, Nick? Why, it has to be the latest edition of Countdown.
Mm-hmm.
And the topic du jour, you like that term, Nick? I learned that today. Du jour. Actually, I didn't learn it today, but everything that people say to sound fancy. The topic du jour is comic book firsts.
Mm-hmm.
What we mean by that is we are going to count down the top comics that we would hand to someone who has never read a comic book before to say, read this, and we think you'll become a fan of comics. So these are five books that each of us, particularly individually, would hand out to our friends to say, we think that this will hook you. Let us think. So did I do a good job of explaining that, Nick? Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different. I think that's part of the appeal of this topic is I probably took it in a little bit different direction. Is it not necessarily this will make you a fan of comics and just fans of these characters, perhaps? But either way, you know, it's all good. It'll all come out in the wash, as it were.
And before we get started, I have an honorable mention out there. And I know this is breaking from our accepted protocol and etiquette, Nick, but I have to throw an honorable mention out because this is a book that I didn't include on my list, and I just now realized that I left it off because it does involve some of Batman's history. But it's a book that I have used to hook not one but two people in the world of DC Comics, and that is a little book called Batman Hush by Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee. I didn't include it in my list, but I wanted to give it a shout-out because whatever it is the book that brought me back to comics after not reading for 5 years and put me back on the journey that led to the Hard Traveling Fanboys, this beautiful friendship that we have between the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and so many other friendships that we have. So I owe a lot of that to Jeff Lonely, and just wanted to give them a little bit of a shout-out.
Absolutely. That one was not on my list either, just because of I think it requires a little bit of knowledge, you know, a little bit of backstory and contextual understanding. Mm-hmm. A good call on your part.
All right. Well, that being said, let's get it started. And do you want to kick us off, Nick, with your number five?
I can. And this was a late change on my list. In full disclosure, I was going to go full to Hard Traveling Fanboy stereotype and have a Jeff Johns book here in my number five slot, but I'll save that for later. You can go a lot of different ways with this topic. As I said earlier, you could go, you know, trying to hook you on characters, but if we're going to take it your direction, Greg, and talk about books that would hook you to the medium, it's hard to make one of these lists, I think, without including something by Alan Moore, who is one of the greatest writers of all time. Mm-hmm. Now, most people would say, you would obviously Watchmen would be the selection here. And I disagree. I don't think Watchmen is the book you put into the hands of a new reader.
Completely agreed.
It's Watchmen is something that kind of relies upon at least a basic understanding of superhero stories and how they work to kind of understand the full context of what Alan Moore is doing. So I'm going to go with an Alan Moore that I've always held in a much higher regard than most do. So I'm going to say V for Vendetta. That's what I'm going to go with from Alan Moore and David Lloyd. And this is a story that originally played out in a serialized format in the short-lived UK anthology Warrior. It was published in black and white, but eventually has been colorized and was adapted into a film, as we all know, with Natalie Portman and Hugo Weaving. But this is a great example of how comics can have, even though they're most known for superheroes or Archie or whatnot that are just these decades-long ongoing stories, this is an example of how comics can be used to tell one story and give it a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And that's what this has. It has outstanding art. It has writing that takes a look at 1980s culture and has a lot to say about where society was headed. It's violent, it's disturbing, and it's not all that unrealistic. Everything about it really is just outstanding. It's expert work from Alan Moore. So if I'm going to recommend a work from Alan Moore to put in the hands of somebody who's never picked up anything before, V for Vendetta, I think, is the one that's most accessible and most relatable for a new reader.
Great. That's an awesome choice that didn't cross my mind, but good call to have an Alan Moore book on here, and this one with him and David Lloyd. You know, we reviewed this in one of our earliest Long Book Hunters, and it really impressed me. It blew me away, in fact, and is one of those books that should be read and revisited because it is very dense, but it's also, for someone who is coming from the world of traditional novels and breaking into comic books, I think it's an awesome bridge to that. A lot of the same themes, the same approach to storytelling, and the same level of density that you might expect from a great novel. So, great choice at number five, Nick. And you mentioned a moment ago not wanting to play into hard-traveling fanboy stereotypes. I just went full board with stereotypes for my list because I think that there's no writer in mainstream superhero comics who is better at introducing concepts to a new audience than Jeff Johns. So kicking off my list at number five, I have Aquaman the Trench by Jeff Johns and Ivan Reis. This, of course, is the kickoff of the Aquaman New 52 series, and it is a crash course in why everything you think you know about Aquaman from hearing him mentioned in pop culture is wrong. So all the jokes that you might have heard on Entourage, all the jokes you might have heard on wrestling or over the years, this is a book that both embraces those jokes and then shows you, actually, Aquaman is really cool, and here's why. We've talked about this book many times over the years on our show and our columns, but Johns and Reis have a way of recontextualizing Aquaman's world, taking the stuff that doesn't work and cutting it out, and taking the stuff that does work and blowing it up and putting it on steroids. So everything about Aquaman that is compelling and unique gets accentuated here. He's given a strong personality, a strong sense of self, a very strong supporting cast, including Mira, who is one of the best written women at DC, and a compelling ass villain in Black Manta, who shows up at one point during this volume. But this is very much about building Aquaman versus building his gallery in this first volume. It's establishing him, his setting, his coworkers, his inner turmoil that I think is inherent in a modern superhero, that he must have some sort of inner conflict. And all it does all of that in spades with a character that I think, if you're handing a book to someone that's never read a superhero book, might be the most unlikely of interesting characters.
Absolutely. This was a selection that narrowly missed my list. I considered it as well, but just opted to not include it because I didn't want to be, have four Jeff Johns entries on the list, which very well could have happened. There were four Jeff Johns stories I considered, and only two of them wound up making the list. But you're right. Jeff Johns, I would argue as well, is probably the best modern comic writer in terms of making things accessible for new and novice, unlike Kurt Busiek.
Oh, my. Well, Nick, your number three or four selection, sorry.
My number four selection. And this one is one I must admit that is a 100% Homer pick. But if you want to talk about books that you could put into the hands of someone and it would make you understand the core of a single character, and you could say, this sums up everything I love about this character in one volume.
I know where you're going.
This is what you should be reading. I gotta go Jason Aaron and Asad Ribic's Thor, God of Thunder. I always count the first two story arcs as one big volume, that of course being God Killer and God Bomb, that big Thor the God Butcher storyline, or excuse me, God Butcher. Yeah, sorry.
This is the book that I just bumped literally right before we went on the air. I bumped this book out of my number five spot. It what a great pick, Nick. Absolutely.
Yeah, so while this isn't necessarily an entry-level look at Thor, it gives you a Thor that is fully realized. It gives you a Thor that is largely unburdened by decades of previous continuity. It's largely starting, a self-contained story, at least initially. It gives you a look at Thor as a young man, Thor as an old man, and Thor in his more classic interpretation alongside the rest of the Marvel Universe. And it largely exists within its own context. You don't need to know what Captain America is off doing at any given point, or what the status quo of the Avengers is, or what Spider-Man is up to. You pretty much just need to know what's in the pages of this book. And it gives you a new villain that is new to both you as a novice and new to longtime readers as well. So you're kind of on equal footing. And it also expands out the Thor mythology in ways that haven't really been touched upon by previous writers either, whether it's the, the library of worlds or whatnot, the different pantheon of gods that are out there. And it just tells this really amazing self-contained story that is deeply emotionally affecting, whether it's the origin of Gore or a look at the old man, the way he's been basically terrified of this one thing coming back to haunt him for the rest of his years, whether it's the hilarity of the interactions between old man Thor and his younger self, or the interactions between younger Thor and his future granddaughters. All this is just so great. It's written expertly by Jason Aaron, and the artistic stylings from Asad Ribic, the greatest Thor artist of all time, for my money anyway. If you have any questions as to why Thor is a character, this is the book I'm going to put in your hands.
You said it perfect, Bubba. I agree with that pick. It's a great pick. And to your point, it's a book that if someone picks it up and they don't like it, then Thor is probably just not going to be for them.
Right.
But if they do like it, then it is a wonderful intro into the world of Thor. And to me, there's no greater match of when I think of a Norse god pantheon than that Asad Ribic art. Mm-hmm. Phenomenal stuff. Well, let's go from Norse mythology and move on into the world of space and galaxies far, far away. Because the number four book on my list is a space opera fantasy book by writer Brian K. Vaughan and artist Fiona Staples, and it is called Saga, and I am including Saga Chapter 1 on this. This is a book that is about a family, essentially, a husband and wife, Alana and Marco, and their daughter Hazel, trying to survive. They're literally star-crossed lovers. Their races are at war with one another. They are in a loving relationship with a young daughter, and they are attempting to evade forces that don't want them to be together, that don't want their daughter to be alive. It's Star Wars. It's a Tolkien-esque fantasy epic, all rolled up into one. And I think you, when we reviewed it the first time, Nick, or when you looked at it the first time, mentioned the similarities to Star Wars, and it's unavoidable because of the alien creatures and the setting, the focus on adventure. But it's also its own unique identity. It is not a ripoff. It doesn't even really wear its influences on its sleeve so much outside of the Star Wars influence and the settings. But the characters are unique. The stories are unique, and it's one of those things that if it ever gets adapted into a movie series or a television show, I think it's going to sweep the entire country because it's that accessible. It's that interesting. It's that funny. Where else are you going to see a guy with a television head taking a dump in the first issue? It's just remarkable in a lot of ways, and I think that the artwork is so clean and so fluid and so interesting that it just marries perfectly with Brian K. Vaughan, who has this way of, like Johns, introducing these wild, out there concepts in a way that for me is more palatable when you first start it than some of the other revered comic book writers when they do a similar individual project like this. I can't say enough good things about this, Nick, and I know at some point we're going to delve more into this series.
Yeah, we will, definitely, but you bring up all great points, and yeah, I hope one day it will get an adaptation of some sort, and it will have the opportunity to become a pop culture phenomenon, much in the way that Walking Dead has, except this one, unlike The Walking Dead, the source material is actually good.
Good.
So there you are. But in any event...
Boy, we're really warming up for Walking Dead, Mark.
Oh, it's going to be a ton of fun. Anyway, moving on to my number 3, I'm going to go cosmic as well, but I'm going to keep it in the DC universe, and there was no way that this list was going to be created without an appearance from the Geoff Johns Green Lantern run, and I was torn on which way to go with it. I think ultimately you kind of have to go in one direction, and I'm going to go with Geoff Johns Green Lantern Secret Origin.
That's my painting!
There you are.
It's my number 3 as well.
Yeah, so... Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run is a perfect example of, in my opinion, the way to slowly ingratiate a new reader into a wider mythology. You start them small and you slowly expand it out. And here with Secret Origin, you get, you know, a look at Hal Jordan, who is just this macho test pilot, and you kind of build this larger mythology around him. You get to introduce things that will come into play, you know, in volumes down the road, or if you've already read the volumes, it's technically what, Greg, took place in issues 32 through 36.
29 through 35.
29 through 35, there you go. So they either will be brought to fruition in story arcs that will come to pass later, or perhaps if you're going back and reading the prior after you read this, everything has a larger meaning, and it's great to have this as a ground level entry point to one of what is, in my opinion anyway, one of the greatest mythologies in all of comics. So yeah, Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run, this is where I would start if you know nothing about Green Lantern.
I think that's awesome too. I pretty much like you, I'm sure, I wrestled between this and Green Lantern Rebirth, and even Green Lantern the very first Green Lantern arc from Geoff Johns and Carlos Pacheco after Rebirth. But ultimately, I settled on Secret Origin with the great art by Ivan Reis, which I think is another important selling point for this book. Ivan Reis's pencils are iconic. There's no other way to describe it. He draws in that traditional Jim Lee style of superheroes. They're muscular. They're not you know, behemoths, but they are muscular. They're gritty. They're traditional, powerful superheroes, and he can also draw some really weird alien creatures, some people that have smaller statures. He does a great job with his variety. He's one of the best artists working in comics, and he is perfect Green Lantern artist alongside Geoff Johns. To your point, Nick, in this we meet Hal Jordan, we meet Carol Ferris, we meet Sinestro, Abensur, Atrocitus, Black Hand, before he was Black Hand, BM Hand. We meet several other members of the Corps. The concept of the Green Lantern Corps, indeed, is introduced to us. It ties together things for people that had already been reading the book, and it introduces things for people that are new to the book to go back and read Wanted Orton and Revenge of the Green Lanterns and all those volumes that came before this one to build towards the epics to come of Blackest Night, Brightest Day, etc. And of course, this was coming right on the heel of Sinestro Corps War. So just a great introduction to Hal Jordan and his universe of characters, what makes Green Lantern compelling, what makes him unique, what makes him tick. And as we mentioned in the Aquaman segment earlier, Johns again introduces the inner conflict that drives Hal Jordan, which is essential to modern superheroes. You have to have some sort of inner conflict that drives you and that causes issues in your life and obstacles in your path. So he does that very well with Hal here. So, yeah, great selection, Nick. So great, I had to make it myself.
Mm-hmm. And then moving on to my number two selection, and this is one I already know is going to be on your list, as you asked about it earlier in the group chat. It would not be a list of best first comics without an appearance from perhaps the most iconic best first comic of all time. That, of course, being Batman Year One from legendary writer Frank Miller and less legendary penciler, we're going to go with David Mazzucchelli. This took place in issues 404 through 407 of Batman way back in 1987, and the origin is one that we have all seen or watched or read in so many different forms throughout the years. And yet I would argue nobody has ever really told it better than Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli did back in these four issues. It is simplistic and yet it is beautiful. It is a book that is able to get you in at the ground level of the character, helps you to understand what makes him tick, and gives him rather simple beginnings. There aren't any supervillains here to fight. He's fighting organized crime. He's fighting a corrupt establishment. He is not at all the bat god of Grant Morrison. He's a man, and he is here.
He's not a bat, he's a man.
He's not a bat, he's a man, damn it. And he is taking on insurmountable odds, seemingly, and through sheer force of will, coming out on the other side. But it's not just Batman that we're introduced here. We get great looks at Alfred Pennyworth. We get great looks at a younger version of Jim Gordon. And we kind of get a sense of what the entire world of Gotham City is all about. So for me, if you're going to try and become a Batman fan, at least in the comic interpretation, you got to start here with Batman Year One.
Totally agreed. Nick, of course, that'll be the last time that book will appear on either of our lists.
Of course.
Well, I'm going to move on to a book that poses a very fascinating philosophical question. What would the world be like without men in it? I think there's probably, given recent events, a strong argument that it would be much better. Nonetheless, this is the question that's tackled by Brian K. Vaughan, another writer that has already appeared on my list, and artist Pia Guerra in their 2002 through 2008 series, Why the Last Men. And this is another story that is being adapted as we speak into television form. But this was a Vertigo title and lasted an incredible 60 issues, telling a strong beginning, middle, and end. To your point earlier, Nick, it's a self-contained story, requires no other reading, and I burned through 7 volumes of this book in record time for me. I think this is one of the fastest books I've ever torn through. It's so compelling, and it centers around a guy and his pet monkey, believe it or not, named Ampersand. And Yorick Brown is the only man left alive after an unknown virus killed every man on the planet. And then we're thrown into turmoil of what happens with the survivors, the women, the families of these men, and who picks up the pieces and keeps the world going. And how does the world keep going in this cataclysmic type event? And how does Yorick survive? How does Yorick move on? There are those around him that he meets that view him as the savior. There are those that view him as the Antichrist. There are those who view him somewhere in between. Some that want to kill him, some that want to kiss him, some that want to keep him at arm's length. It is one of the best comics I've ever read, period. It is a great comic to introduce someone to the medium because it takes advantage of the medium in a lot of ways, with great art from Piaguera, with really clever dialogue, and with an out-there concept that is original and interesting and explored in a way that only comics can do. So I thought this was excellent the first time I read it, and I still would gladly hand this book off to anybody who expressed interest in reading a comic.
Outstanding. Yeah, I've read this one as well, enjoyed it very much, and honestly drew a complete blank on it, so good on you for including it on your list. But moving on to my number one, and here comes the most anticlimactic number one in possibly any of our countdowns ever, because if I'm going to put any comic in the hands of someone and say, this is, you know, this is a great place to start, this tells you everything you need to know about this character, it requires no prior knowledge, I'm going to give them the book that I got started on. And that, of course, is the first hardcover edition of Ultimate Spider-Man by Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley, issues 1 through 13, I believe, collected together in one hardcover, and it's outstanding. As a matter of fact, I just recently reread those issues after completing Spider-Man, the video game for PlayStation 4. It's one of the most accessible comics you'll ever come across, because it's not just starting, you know, with a creative run. It is launching an entirely new universe, unconstrained by prior continuity. Brian Michael Bendis is able to take the direction, the narrative, in any direction he wants to take it, really. And so you get the classic Spider-Man origin, but granted fleshed out a bit to give a bit more context, to give a bit more time to get inside Peter's head as a 15-year-old kid, to get inside, you know, that house and understand what his relationships are with not only the people he goes to school with, but of course Aunt May and Uncle Ben. And it also contemporizes it a little bit. You know, it dates it from the 1960s up into the early 2000s, and it helps it to take on a bit more of a relatable tact for, you know, younger readers today and people who, you know, have a hard time relating to, say, talk of wheat cakes at the breakfast table and that kind of thing. So, and along the way, Mark Bagley just draws everything perfectly, whether it's the action sequences with Spider-Man himself or whether it's the facial expressions, because the great thing about this case, it's just as much about Peter Parker as it is about Spider-Man. And if you're anything like me, you read this and you find yourself wanting to get to the next Peter Parker sequence, even more so than the Spider-Man stuff, because you feel for this kid and you're pulling for him and you want to see things go well for him, because he's not perfect, but he's trying his best. And that's just, there's something utterly relatable to that, and always has been in the Spider-Man mythos. So for me, as it always has been, Ultimate Spider-Man, the first, that's where I'm going. I believe that's even the one I made you read all those years ago, Greg.
That's correct. We did. We reviewed it for our column, I believe.
Yep, we did.
And yeah, this is another good pick here. Obviously, I remember from our column days, I didn't love it quite to the degree that Nick did from reading it from a different age, but I will certainly acknowledge it is a great introductory comic for anyone, particularly a younger reader. If you have anyone that is a teenager or something that maybe has never picked up a comic, this would be a great book to give them, because it's loaded with humor, it's loaded with interesting characters, modernized, as Nick pointed out, takes on a lot of these characters from the 60s. That the characters are great, but sometimes the surroundings or the settings you know, might not connect with a young reader when they're seeing somebody write on a typewriter or something. So a lot of good modernizations here. I particularly love Peter Parker's interactions with the Kingpin in this one. It's rivals anything that's ever been done with Peter and the Kingpin that I've read in the 6-1, that so-called 616 universe. So yeah, this is a great pick. I can't say anything bad about it, Nick. If you have Ultimate Spider-Man, get it in the hands of a young reader, because it could hook them for life on comics, as it did with Nick. Mm-hmm. My number one, shock of shocks, has already appeared on Nick's list. It is the aforementioned Batman Year One by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. Nick already said a lot of what I would say about this and why it is number one on my list, but ultimately it came down to me. Batman is the most popular and recognizable superhero, certainly in the United States, if not the world. But certainly in our country, Batman is number one. He dominates the sales charts in comics. He dominates the box office. He is an icon in our culture. People like the brooding, dark, sort of vigilante figure. That has kind of become what culture looks to versus the archetypes of Superman back in the day, or versus the archetypes of Spider-Man even. So, with Batman being the most popular and the most universally loved character, arguably, in comics, I felt I had to go to a book that introduces the version of Batman that most people are attached to, which would be either the Michael Keaton, the Christian Bale, the Kevin Conroy, whatever of those versions is your favorite, Ben Affleck. You can tie it all back in many ways to this book, Batman Year One, which itself owes itself to The Dark Knight Returns, but this to me works better as a standalone because it introduces the entire concept of Batman. Who is Batman and what will he become? We see that from the ground up. It represents the fullest realization of the grounded street-level Batman. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Absolutely.
And we would see it, of course, if somebody does read this, and they are as blown away by it as I think they would be, then you can hand them The Long Halloween. You can hand them Dark Victory. You can hand them Hush, even. You can hand them The Black Mirror. You can hand them virtually any major Batman book that followed after this. You can hand them that book, and it would make more sense to them because now they will understand why that Batman is the way he is. Whereas before Year One, Batman, yes, he was a dark character, but he did not quite have this level of grittiness to him. So and on top of all of that, it is an absolutely beautiful book. The artwork is amazing. It is probably a more, I would say, aesthetically welcoming art style than what The Dark Knight Returns has, which is itself a very gritty artwork. Big fan of this one. This is the one, I think, that if I had to take a comic book, hand it to somebody that is maybe one of my coworkers that is scoffing at the notion, and I would say, hey, if you've ever seen a superhero movie and liked it, read this. I think you'll dig it. Again, a lot of those elements from a great novel are found in this book. So Batman Year One is my number one. Nick, let's remind the people what our lists were to this point.
Okay, at number five, I had V for Vendetta. At number four, I had Thor, God of Thunder. At number three, I had Green Lantern, Secret Origin. At number two, I had Batman Year One. And at number one, I had Ultimate Spider-Man.
And at number five, I had Aquaman, Volume 1. At number four, I had Saga. At number three, I had Green Lantern, Secret Origin. At number two, I had Why the Last Man, Volume 1. At number one, I had Batman Year One. Well, there you have it, folks. Those are our lists. Let us know what you think about the books that made our list, and let us know what we could have done better. Let us know your lists, most importantly. We want to hear them. Tweet us at gphillips862, at nickduke87. Go to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and leave us a comment under this shared link, or just post, and we'd be happy to discuss your lists with you. You can email them, gregp@placemanation.com, nickd@placemanation.com, or you can tweet us at ptbnpop on Twitter.
PTBN Comics.
PTBN Comics. I do that every week now. Every week, Nick. Nonetheless, PTBN Comics, loneliest Twitter address on the internet, and we hope to hear from you in the very, very near future. Nick, any last thoughts on this before we take a commercial break and head back on the other side?
No, I already took my veiled pot shot at the Avengers run from last week's episode. So, yeah, no, I'm good.
You're just continuing to dig us a hole, my friend, but nevertheless,
I was once told by someone, Greg, that you should really live your life, base your entire outlook on life on that one Eric Bischoff quote, controversy creates cash.
Creates cash, yep. Very true. Very true. Well, we're going to take a break, folks, and when we come back, we'll have plenty more controversy for you in the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
We're back from the other side of the break. What a great list of shows we've got here at Place to Be Nation Pop, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. We encourage all of you to go check out the brand new podcast by Russell Sellers with his guest Todd Weber as they are addressing Crisis on Infinite Earth as part of DC Post-Crisis Management. Looking forward to that one. Go check that out. And also go to check out brand new episodes of Geek and Sassy. We've got a new Talking Pop coming soon. I was on Freak Out Drive-In recently. Freak out! Highly recommended. We just got a veritable heaven of podcasts to check out here, so be sure and do that. Now, I can't think of any other thing that I'd rather do right now, Nick, than talk about the news and notes of the comic world. What about you?
That sounds awesome. Let's do that.
Let's enter a segment we like to call Welcome to the Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Well, to kick things off, Nick, sit in the L-shaped studio. You've scurried off into a certain corner.
I have. Why don't you come over here and join me?
I think I will. I think I'll. Why is Lyle Lovett right beside you with his hand up on your thigh?
Well, Dwight's over here giving me the eye as well.
Oh, guys, Dwight, you don't have to fight. Hot dog, Nick. We're getting lucky tonight.
And we're getting lucky in the DCEU corner.
That's right. The DCEU corner. Get lucky every time. And this month's luck, or this week's luck, rather, comes in that Birds of Prey, a movie that neither Nick nor I is actually convinced will happen, continues to develop. And now they have cast their Black Canary and their Huntress. Mm-hmm. And those individuals, of course, are the well-known, established actors... Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who will be playing the Huntress, which a former mafia princess who was devastated at a young age when her family was killed in a mob hit, turning her into a vigilante. And Journey Smollett-Bell has been cast as Black Canary. Or as former Troy Ed Hedden would say, Black Canary. So it looks like this movie is moving forward a little bit, Nick.
Yeah, it certainly appears that way. And I think even the report was this recently that they're targeting an early 2020 release date for it as well. So seemingly they're moving forward aggressively with it, but I'm still somewhat skeptical about the entire thing. I'm skeptical about everything involving DC at this point.
Absolutely. Our DCEU corner, the drywall is starting to rot out.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of questions about it. I will say, I'm a pretty big fan of this Black Canary casting.
Why that is?
She has the look of a Black Canary.
Does she now?
Type person.
Does
not
she
a literal?
Now?
Not a literal Black Canary, but the character Black Canary. So, I like it. I'm willing to let it play out and see where it goes.
I bet you are. I would thank you for not near me, though, while you're letting it play
out.
Hey!
You're trying to ascribe some sort of naughtiness to it, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, that's not all for the DCEU corner, because we also...
That is awesome.
On the... Joker and Harley Quinn film that is being worked on by Glenn Ficarra and John Requa, the writers there, who have also written Bad Santa and This Is Us. The news that came out is that this movie is going to start out with Harley napping Dr. Phil, who they hope will be played by Dr. Phil, but they're not committed to that. They'll take the real Dr. Phil if he's available. The important thing is that it is his character, Dr. Phil. I think this news has broken Nick.
Continue.
This is a relationship movie, but with a sensibility Bad Santa effed up mentally deranged people, according to one of the writers. The writer also said, I don't know where it is on the queue of DC movies.
Let's hope not. You. We're going to hope with not.
Oh, come on, Nick. Give us your unfiltered thoughts on what I just read to you.
This sounds like one of the most fucking ridiculous things I've ever heard. And I love Bad Santa, Greg. You know my noted love of the film. You know how high the esteem in which I hold it. I watch it every year around the holidays. I think it's a more cynical look at the Christmas spirit and whatnot, and I very much enjoy it. But these guys haven't really done anything since that I've enjoyed. And the whole Dr. Phil thing just sounds ridiculous. And also, casting the Joker and Harley Quinn in a, quote, relationship movie kind of misses the entire point. The entire point is that they shouldn't be in a relationship because he's abusive as fuck. Like, what exactly are you trying to do, characters?
I couldn't tell you, Nick. I couldn't tell you. But the important thing is we might get more of Jared Leto's Joker.
Oh, God. I don't actually think, I honestly don't think this happens, though. I mean, Margot Robbie's already doing one Harley-focused movie with Birds of Prey. I have a hard time seeing them coming back with another one so quickly after.
Now, come on, Nick. Admit it. We need to give Leto a chance to riff shout his portrayal of the Joker.
Nope. No, we don't.
Okay, fair enough. One thing that did flesh its way out is Batman's penis. Let me explain. This past week, a controversy arose. I suppose you'd call it a controversy, Nick. In the first issue of Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo's Batman Damned. Well, in that first issue, print issue at least, Batman, Bruce Wayne, at one point is walking in the nude, and Lee Bermejo drew a shadowy, a penis, a bat dick.
Yes.
If you will. Not dick bats, which is totally different. Right. We've talked about here on the show. This is a bat dick, or a bat Grayson. Mm-hmm. Sorry. And Batman's bat Grayson is there. It is there in its glory. And horror, apparently, if you're the pearl-clutching type. And many express their disgust, I suppose, at this, or their disappointment, rather. I don't know what they expressed, but whatever happened, DC has launched their usual, I guess, editorial standpoint on this, that they have blacked out the scene in the digital edition, and that future reprints will have the scene blacked out, well, the penis, rather, not the entire scene, because, quote, it was not additive to the story. Now, I actually, in all joking aside, I actually have an issue with this from a marketing perspective, because it's DC. They can censor their own books however they want to. That's not an issue. It's their content. It's not being censored by the government. But at the same time, isn't the entire point of Black Label that it is supposed to be, quote, mature, adult-oriented comics?
I thought that was the intent.
If there had been, let's say, Catwoman's boobs in this issue, do you think that DC would have taken the same steps?
No. Nope.
And in fact, Black Label, which is in some ways the inheritor of the legacy of Vertigo, if you go back and read Vertigo comics, go read Preacher, go read almost anything by Alan Moore from pre-Vertigo days, go read Green Arrow under Mike Grell, you're going to see a lot of, a certain someone that I talked to this week would say, big old titties. So why, in one scene, in an unimportant moment, and is it a problem?
And it's bathed in shadow. Like, you kind of have to look for it to even see.
See a shadowy penis hanging from a nude male figure. How did those tits in prior comics enhance the stories, Nick?
Well, they did, because comics are both created and consumed by a predominantly male audience, and so we don't have a problem with that. And yet we have a, so we, that means we have a problem with this. No, it's absolutely right. I don't understand the controversy over it, and I don't even understand, like, it's funny to a certain extent. I don't understand the big deal about it in general. You know what I mean? Like, we knew it was.
It's certainly above average.
It's a fine sized deal. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is, we already knew this was an adult themed like book focused at a more niche, older readership. So why are we surprised by it? Why does this matter? Like, why is Batman's penis all that people care about in relation to this book?
I couldn't tell you, Nick. Couldn't tell you, because this controversy and over the discussion about this book. But I will say it's also made the first printing very valuable. And so maybe more people are buying this book than they would have without the controversy. So I don't know. But regardless, I have a huge issue with the hypocritical policy of DC to black that out. I thought that was weak and should be revisited. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, we transfer from that rather silly issue to a very serious one, and that is in Broke. Pretty close to publishing time, actually, of this podcast. And that is that longtime Batman artist, Norm Breyfogle, or perhaps Breyfogle. I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce it. I'm going to go with Breyfogle because that's how I always pronounced it when I was a kid. Nonetheless, he passed away at the far too young age of 58, just today as we record this. He is best known for his run on various Batman books alongside writer Alan Grant, so writer John Wagner. And he was one of a list of creators, Nick, that the best way I can describe is he was drawing Batman when I was first getting comics, when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. And I didn't really understand how comics were made. I would see these names at the beginning of a comic book, and it would say writer or artist or whoever, but I didn't have a conception of what that meant. I didn't really get it until a few years later, maybe when I was 8, 9, I started to understand, okay, the writer does the words, the artist does the pictures, things of that nature. But he was one of those guys like Jurgens, like Roger Stern, like Jerry Ordway, Alan Grant, who I mentioned a moment ago as a writer, Jim Aparo or Aparo, that I would see in these comics. And I didn't know who they were. I didn't know what their faces looked like. I didn't know what their role necessarily were behind the scenes. But I knew that they were important, and I knew that they were responsible for getting this content to me that I was enjoying so much as a kid. And Norm was one of those guys. He was a guy that Batman Shadow of the Bat, which he launched with Alan Grant, through Detective Comics and through Batman, created a litany of long lasting characters for Batman. And here's just some of the ones that he's created. He was credited with co-creating Anarchy, Jeremiah Arkham, Victor Zsasz, Amygdala, Ratcatcher, and most famously, the Ventriloquist and Scarface, who I know have a very special place in your heart, Nick, as Batman villains. And, you know, he also helped launch Malibu's flagship character, Prime. But his Batman in particular, it stood out. It was this kind of dynamic, pulpy figure that also had the flair of the superhero books of the day. He drew a very unique Batmobile. I don't think anybody's ever drawn it the same as him before or since. He was one of the primary artists of Tim Drake as he was becoming Robin, and drew him younger, drew him to the point where he actually looked like a kid that was playing Robin, as opposed to other artists in that time and even later that I always thought drew Tim to look older than he actually was. He had a way of, like the great artists do, he and Kelly Jones, who was another prominent bad artist at that time, were doing distinctive work on Batman where each book looked different from the others and leaving their own imprint on the character. So today for the comics world, 58 is too young to leave a family behind. But nonetheless, he will be remembered for all of his great contributions to the books that a lot of not just myself, but a lot of kids grew up reading in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wasn't reading at the time like you were, so he didn't have the formative ME that he clearly did on you. But some of those images, I'm looking back through a gallery right now on Google Images, and yeah, there's one cover in particular, a cover of Detective Comics with Batman standing in silhouette in the rain, and it's just like, I recognize that cover, even though I would have never read it at the time. So, outstanding choice to include this on the rundown, Greg. Good to hear the impact he had on your life.
Very good. Well, let's move on to the TV world of DC Comics, and let's get on to some more to some happier news here, and that is the upcoming crossover later this year between Arrow, The Flash, and Supergirl, which will introduce Batwoman, is going to be titled Elseworlds, which is a word and a title that has special meaning to fans of DC Comics. That, of course, was the name of the imprint that DC used to, or the label that DC used to put out their sort of what-if scenarios back in the day. The stuff like Batman, Red Rain, things where they would do kind of alternate universe takes on their characters. And so that's what the name of this one is, and we have got our villain, who will be Dr. Destiny. Will be apparently the villain of this piece. People may remember Dr. Destiny from the standing Justice League cartoon appearance of him, one of my favorite episodes, which gives us the immortal Batman line, my mind is in a very nice place to be. And so that was a great episode. Looking forward to Dr. Destiny. But even more exciting than that, I think, Nick, is the potential that this has for the future, because, ladies and gentlemen, The Monitor is coming to the CW universe.
And where there is a monitor, there must also be an anti-monitor.
You're damn right. LaMonica Garrett has been cast as the Monitor for the crossover event. And while technically he was cast for this crossover event, I think both of us believe that he is going to be used to set up next year's crossover event, which I suspect will be our first crisis level event we've ever gotten filmed.
Yes, I am making the fantasy, you know, fantasy book of that as well, that we have this one, we get Batwoman on the table, and then next year we go full on and we get all these heroes on one Earth finally, after years of having the distinct separate realities.
Yep, and that includes Black Lightning as well. And the potential is there. If they do a cross all the shows for an entire week, the potential is there for pop-up appearances from other alternate universe television superheroes, whether it be characters from Smallville, Lois and Clark, the 1990 Flash. There's any number of possibilities of crossovers. Krypton, even as much as we deride it, Gotham, you know, there's just so much of a potential crossover here that they could do, just cameo appearances. It's very exciting for what it could mean for the future. Not to take the attention away from this year's crossover, but I think just the idea of this is for DC fans kind of what it was like for the Marvel fans when we were building towards the Avengers movie. So pretty exciting stuff here.
Absolutely. Can't wait to see where this goes in the future, and I hope we're not artificially raising our own hopes.
Yeah, but, you know, after so many years, Nick, we do get into a pattern of raising our hopes, and sometimes that leads to us being crushingly disappointed. With increasing frequency, that has happened in the world of The Walking Dead. But nonetheless, undeterred by declining ratings, undeterred by fan outcry over the last season, the makers and the producers of The Walking Dead at AMC announced this week, or last week rather, that they are planning to turn The Walking Dead into a full-fledged multimedia franchise with multiple movies and several more TV spinoffs over the next 10 years. This according to Bloomberg. The news organization cites that AMC is talking to several large media companies about partnering on the projects, and that it could cost several hundred million dollars. Well, I understood Fear the Walking Dead to a degree when it launched, telling a story about the immediate days after the outbreak and a different group of survivors in a different area. But how many of the same story can you tell, Nick?
I don't know. I would argue you can't tell two currently, but that's just me. Like,
yeah.
And if you were going to make this big, giant push into film and various other spinoffs, wouldn't you have served by doing it when the property was at its apex, when it was at its hottest, not when seemingly it's declining now?
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, remember a few years ago when, I can't remember which movie studio it was, that wanted to launch the horror movie connected universe?
Dark Universe. Universal's Dark Universe.
Yes. And they did this, and they planned all this out without even waiting to see if the Tom Cruise-led Mummy reboot was going to work.
Truthfully, it didn't.
It did not. And then all of their plans, their multi-million dollars worth of plans, went up in smoke. This feels like that. I mean, we went over this on the show a couple years ago, but...
This feels worse than that, honestly. Like, The Mummy, you know, if you're sitting there from a studio perspective, you're going, okay, it's a Tom Cruise movie, dumb big summer action movie. Those typically make money, right? Walking Dead is already showing signs of being in the full-on decline. The ratings are dwindling. Not dwindling, I guess that's not a fair term. They're down, though. Unquestionably, they're down. I think fan outcry is at a all-time high. I think you are seeing the signs that we've been to the top of the Walking Dead mountain, and it's all downhill from here. And so to try and launch this expanded interconnected universe or 10-year plan or whatever, when you're on the backside of this pop culture phenomenon, it seems like something that's doomed to fail.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think that it's putting the cart before the horse. I think the first thing that I would do if I were in charge of AMC is I would rally my troops around the primary Walking Dead show, and I would make sure that I had a quality product that was giving something that made them want to keep watching. Because one thing that is clear is many people have stopped watching over the last couple of years for various reasons, not all creative related, but certainly I would draw the horses together instead of spreading them farther apart. And again, this comes down to personal bias. I think the inherent flaw in any long-term Walking Dead plans is that Robert Kirkman himself, has a long-term plan for his book. So it's just seeing how many studios he can get to invest in him, which, hey, I'm not criticizing him for that, by the way. Get your money, man. Do what you can. But if I'm a studio, I'm not investing unless I see a firm idea for what this story is. If you're just going with a property with no story, I don't know. There's only so much you can milk out of this. And I agree with you, Nick. It seems destined to fail, frankly. Maybe you could get a movie out of the Walking Dead universe right now. But a series of movies and a series of other spinoffs with, by the way, still no indication that they're ever going to reveal what caused the zombie outbreak, because Kirkman says it's not important.
I think AMC at this point is also laboring under the delusion that the interesting thing to people is the zombies and the settings, which it isn't. The interesting thing is the characters.
It's
the reason why, you know, Fear the Walking Dead, while it's been moderately successful, will never be as successful as the main show because we aren't as ingratiated to the characters. So... Mm-hmm. That's the problem. You can keep trying to make multiple spinoffs or whatnot, but if you don't have characters just as intriguing and just as engaging as classic, you know, original Walking Dead characters, then it's not going to happen.
Exactly. And as you know, Nick, some can have multiples and some can have only one. And I think with The Walking Dead, one would be enough. Yes. Well, unfortunately, the one area of the Walking Dead sort of ancillary spinoff universe that has been very successful, particularly to us creatively, has been the Telltale Studios Walking Dead series. Nick and I both have raved about seasons 1 and 2 of the Walking Dead game. We haven't played season 3 of the Walking Dead game. But we are looking forward to that at some point. Next year, we'll have played it. And Telltale was getting ready to release the fourth and final season of The Walking Dead, to the point that they'd even released gameplay footage of the game.
They released one episode already. They had released two episodes. The episode had just hit this past week and then was instantly pulled down, I think, 2 days later.
And so ultimately, the big news of the last few days that has thrown water on the fire that people had for this game is that Telltale announced on Friday that it was enacting a majority studio closure. Hundreds of jobs lost. Every game they were working on, with the exception of Minecraft, canceled. It was, apparently, reading this article on GameSpot, it was a shock to the industry. Nobody saw it coming. It was not anticipated. Apparently, there was a lawsuit involved. The Walking Dead's final season has been pulled. It may never see the light of day. Certainly will never be completed. And stuff like the Batman series will not get a sequel. The Guardians of the Galaxy game that I was raving about on this podcast just a couple months ago will not be completed, have a sequel. The Wolf Among Us, which I know people were really excited about getting a sequel to that game, will not happen. A real bummer here, Nick, for a studio that I would say in a lot of ways reignited my love of gaming for a while there. The Walking Dead games and the Batman game were the most fun that I've had playing a video game in many years. So it was a pretty big bummer for me to hear this news the other day.
Incredibly disappointing. You know, which goes to show you that there isn't much room for difference in gaming these days. You know, Telltale was one of the studios that was focused on giving you story-driven games first and foremost, and games that weren't built entirely around action-based, fast-paced gameplay. And yet, there just didn't seem to be a market for this. I know The Walking Dead did pretty well. Batman did okay, but they pretty much said the reason they had to do this is because they couldn't make money. And it's very disappointing when a studio produces a series of games that almost across the board are critically beloved, and yet we just can't find a place for them in the industry. So, very disappointing. Yeah. Hopefully I'll get around to finishing Walking Dead at some point, but you know, and there are rumors that they're trying to find somebody to take over production on the last two episodes to actually finish the game, but there's no telling if that's ever going to happen or not.
Right. And the one thing that I hope is that Clementine, if they are going to continue the Walking Dead universe on TV, Clementine is arguably a better character than what we've seen on the TV show, even. Certainly better than the ones in the comics that I've encountered. So I hope that her story gets to live on, maybe through an adaptation or something. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. She's a great character, and it would be a shame to lose her to time. Mm-hmm. But speaking of time, we are out of time on the rundown. That's the end of it. We got nothing else, Nick, on that one.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it's time for our longest running segment on the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And that is Reading and Watching. So I actually, for the first time in what feels like an eternity, picked up a physical comic book, turned the pages, and read most of it. Haven't finished it yet. It is the giant-sized Action Comics special, and this came out several months ago. I don't see a month on the cover here. I'm going to assume in April or May. And it's got three different stories in it. One by Dan Jurgens, and that is an excellent story about Superman and Lex and their conflict with one another, and Superman encountering a time-traveling man, Lex, from the future, who's trying one last time to kill him. And it's a fun story that where Superman expresses some restraint in not revealing to young Lex what has happened. The artwork is pretty good. Will Conrad's the artist here. It's solid art, nothing spectacular, but very solid. Enjoyed it. The second story is by Mark Russell, and the art is... Let me see if I can turn the page to this point. The art is by Jill Thompson, who, of course, has designed the ring attire for Daniel Bryan and CM Punk and others. But the artwork is good here. I did not like the story, though. The premise was fine. It's a Lex story. The problem is I thought the dialogue was real bad. It takes place at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and so Clark and Lois are put in the position of telling jokes. And neither of them are good at telling jokes. The problem is the audience is scripted here to laugh at all of the jokes, including the Justice League, who are in attendance and laughing at all the jokes. And that's an issue when they're not funny. So didn't enjoy this one very much, this particular story. And then the last part of the story I haven't read yet. That is by Max Landis and Francis Manapul. It looks gorgeous, but I haven't got into that one yet. So I just wanted to give an update. I am in the process of reading a physical comic book, Nick. Stop the presses.
Wow. Yeah, and for me, I didn't really read anything other than I reread a bunch of Ultimate Spider-Man that I've already talked about tons of times in our columns and on this podcast, so no need to litigate that event.
No need to tread over that ground. And then watching. What you been watching, Nick?
Nothing.
Same. I was thinking, right? Thinking. I got nothing. I haven't watched a damn thing. Playing?
Finished it. Talked about it last week.
Yep. Anything else playing? No?
Nope.
Yeah, I got nothing then. So we're done.
That's it.
See you next time, folks.
Bye.
Oh, we got a couple other things to go through here. So we're done with reading and watching. But I did notice, Nick, that I looked up at the clock and, by God, wouldn't you know it, a minute on the clock. It's time for the wrestling minute. By George, I haven't watched SmackDown yet, but I did watch Raw. Mm-hmm. And interesting developments. I liked the one-night storyline of who's going to turn. I enjoyed that. I wonder if it's planting the seeds for something here.
Let's hope so, but long-term storytelling has not been their strong suit in recent years.
Quite true, but I did enjoy them trying it for one night only. Even appreciated the attempted symbology of the chairs that Braun and his crew were carrying out. I'm hoping for big things for Drew in the future. I think Monday Night established he's going to be a megastar. New Japan show coming up this weekend, Nick.
This weekend? My God.
This weekend, this Sunday, Omega and Okada on opposite sides of a tag match in the main event.
Gonna have to check that out. Yes. I am woefully behind on New Japan, but what else is new?
What else is new indeed? And other than that, just enjoying the shows, folks.
Shawn Michaels impending in-ring return?
Yes, Shawn Michaels allegedly to team with Triple H against the Brothers of Destruction. Hashtag Cameron's everything. And then allegedly, if you believe the rumors de jour, to have a singles match against The Undertaker Survivor Series. Would be something, Nick.
It would be something.
Well, that's been the Wrestling Minute. With that said, next week we are going to be kicking off Walking Dead Month. How we're going to be kicking it off, we haven't decided yet. We're going to decide that at another time. I have not conversed with Hogan. I did talk to The Rock backstage. And he said, we're going to get to Walking Dead Month, and we're going to give you content in Walking Dead Month, and you're just going to have to wait and see what it is. It's today. Got a commitment to join us for our annual guest star, Jennifer Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, I could tell from the tone of her voice and her conversation earlier, she's just as excited about Walking Dead Month as everyone else is this year, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're all so excited to be continuing this fine October tradition.
Indeed. Now, Nick, you had mentioned to me in somewhat of a stupor the other day that you had another segment planned for our show, and I would like to ask now what that segment is.
What?
You don't remember this happening?
No.
Well, you were in a stupor, as I mentioned. You said, I got a new segment for HTF coming soon. You're just going to have to wait for it. And I said, come on, tell me what it is. And you said, no, you're just going to have to wait for it.
Listen, listen. Don't lend any credence to what that man said. That man has nothing to do with this.
Oh, very good. Well, in that case, folks, we are going to wrap things up. Nick's been feeling under the weather. Yes. We're going to wrap up and hope that you stay tuned next week and you haven't gotten tired of our crappy takes on things. We will be back next week with a brand new episode to kick off Walking Dead month, to get us in the spirit of Halloween season and the return of Rick Grimes and his crew. So we'll catch you then.
Our traveling fanboys.